You'll remember that at the end of Canto 5, Dante had fallen as if dead on the floor of the second round in hell. And at the beginning of Canto 6, he awakens in the third round. Suddenly, he's suddenly there. And I think that this signifies something about how new aspects of reality are beginning to awaken to him. It's almost as if they're already there, but his imagination now is just beginning to be able to grasp that they're there. So he doesn't, as it were, travel into the third round of hell. The third round of hell appears to him as his imaginative capacity to sort of perceive it and receive it begins to develop. And that's one of the themes in Canto 6, that Dante shows the first signs of his awareness of the depth of reality that this descent into hell is beginning to work on him and show up to him. He's beginning to become capable of discerning it. Commentators often note how this canto too has a very different tone and feel from the previous one. The canto on love and lust had a kind of high poetic kind of quality. Suddenly, we go into a much more visceral, guttural, short, sharp kind of poetry. There are lists of adjectives without much attempt to string together in beautiful ways. This is showing us we're in a different kind of state of being as well. And it's underlined early on in the canto, where Dante says just quite straightforwardly, "I am in the third round." He doesn't even sort of go into, we then, as it were, moved into the third round. He's saying very directly, and there's something about that directness, that immediacy, which shapes the whole feel of this third round. Immediately they notice that this is a place of sort of relentless rain. It's like being in a daytime storm where the atmosphere goes grey, the light fades, you can't tell what's near and far away, it's relentless, it's hard to tell the time, the sun's disappeared, it's that very kind of wet, greasy, thick deluge that obliterates, in a way, all boundaries. You're not quite sure where you begin and the world ends. Everything is flowing awash in this water. And that, again, is a very powerful theme of this third round. It's a kind of state of being where everything becomes a kind of mush, a foul, undifferentiated whole. It's also an anhedonic place, as we'd say in psychotherapy. There's no pleasure here, no capacity even to know how to receive pleasure. It's grey, and there's no sunrise, sun setting. The weather doesn't give shape to the day. You're not sure where you are even, and pleasure sort of dissolves into the wetness around you. It reminded me actually very much of Chris Rea's famous song, "The Road to Hell," where he talks about where the river doesn't flow, how it boils with poison, how there's no light, how fear and violence seems to emerge from every pore of the place. This is the road to hell. And while in the third round, in hell, it feels like Dante and Virgil are now directly experiencing this. It's called often the round of the gluttonous, but I think that this word is slightly misleading now because it doesn't, I don't think, mean just kind of gorging and eating a lot. It certainly doesn't mean obesity. I think what it means is something a bit more subtle, and pushing towards this more profound sense of the round is important because I think that's what's beginning to happen for Dante. He's beginning to be able to see things with more clarity, more understanding, and so push more deeply into the state of things. And I think what this round's really about is a kind of lustful weddedness to the material world, to materiality. It's like the assumption is that life will only be satisfied with more and more material things. Now, that's why this round feels so formless or soulless, we might say. Because in the medieval understanding, which I think is still a good understanding, actually, that pure matter gains its shape, gains its beauty, gains its relationship gains its place in the world and so becomes a proper ecology. Matter gains that when it's infused with soul. When is it where we can tell the difference between things? We can tell that a tree has a certain vitality and a rock has another vitality, where the weather itself has a kind of quality and a character. You know, the sun feels very different from the night. The rain has its own sets of qualities, which brings it alive, in fact, you know, the refreshing rain. Whereas in this third round, all those qualities of the material world have turned to mush, have turned to foulness. And so its life is literally draining out of it. And that, I think, is the kind of key insight into a life which is purely wedded to the material. That actually it drains the life out of it. And because it's a bit like walking, I don't know, through the terminal of an airport, where it's all sort of bright lights. Everything is dressed in gold and red. You can't really tell the difference between a packet of cigarettes and a bottle of perfume and then a box of chocolates and some kind of highly branded garment. It all sort of just blares at you with the same intensity. That's very much what this round feels like. I mean, in fact, some modern artists have depicted this round sort of where brand names just show up everywhere you stare, you know, so much so that you just kind of feel sated and bloated with all these material so-called goods, and they lose all their good in that overabundance. So I think it's that sort of sense of gluttony and being sated, this much more material sense of it, that this round is starting to tease out, starting to push towards our attention as it arises up in Dante's attention. They meet, first of all, the fantastic beast Cerberus, who's the three-headed dog-like creature. In classical mythology, guards the entrance to the underworld. Dante does his own thing with Cerberus. He's got kind of human qualities as well as dog-like qualities. But what you take from him overall is that, again, this is a kind of living creature that doesn't really know what it's for. It's just sort of, as it were, pure, undifferentiated instinct. It so becomes monstrous, out of control and monstrous. Dante talks about how its muscles are twitching, its head's just writhing. It's tearing at things without really knowing why. And in fact, when Virgil approaches, Virgil knows just to throw it some of the mud, some of the muck off the ground. And Cerberus just grabs it and consumes it unthinkingly. And it satisfies him for a moment. But of course, only for a moment. But nonetheless, it's strangely a monster that's quite easily controlled because it's so unthinking. Just throw mud at it and it'll sort of be happy. It's like a dog without the intelligence that dogs have. It's like a dog that's been traumatized. You know, if you have pets and dogs, you'll know that actually they're incredibly smart creatures. They're very aware of their environment. They're very responsive. They have souls. They have presences which are shaped by habits, shaped by loyalties, shaped by affection, shaped by tasks. Cerberus is like an anti-dog. Where all that has gone, that soulfulness, that intelligence, that reason, you might say. We were talking about reason as the kind of harmony and resonance with the divine presence in the cosmos. This third round is where that reason has been stripped away, and all you're left with is sort of kind of sheer living flesh in this dog Cerberus, which is strangely a mixture of terrifying, but also easily placated, in fact, because it's sort of dumb flesh. Soulless flesh. What's also really interesting is that when they start to notice the souls in this third round, they notice they're all lying down. And in fact, even more striking is that Dante, who has a living body, is able to step on these souls. Now that's actually quite a rare feature in hell. Normally the souls don't have bodies because the bodies have been left on earth. The souls have left their bodies behind. And commentators wonder why, in this third round, Dante is able to step on the bodies. What is it that gives these bodies substance? And my sense is it's because their bodies, their souls that haven't quite left their physical bodies behind. Remember, we're in this kind of psycho-imaginal zone. where what is psychologically experienced shows up tangibly before you. And I think that these bodies that they have in the third round are actually the kind of echo of their physical body, that because they haven't been able to leave physical life behind, materiality behind, they've kind of carried into them, with them into this round of hell. And so Dante's actually even able to tread on them, such is their weddedness to the physical world. And again, it's a bit like the stories you hear sometimes of hauntings, where the haunting is caused by a soul who doesn't really know they've died, who doesn't want to leave this material world behind them, and so hangs around. Well, in a way, the souls in the third round of hell have left the physical world, but they've kind of dragged it with them too. I think this also explains why they're lying down, as well as being able to be trod upon. And they're lying down because they lack what in the material understanding was known as levity. Now, levity is that which rises up to the heavens. It's the spirited nature of things. It's the soulful life in things. And it counters what was known then as gravity, which was that which causes things to sink, to lie down. It's like their material pole, as opposed to their spiritual pole, which is represented by levity. And in a good creative creature, or in a living organism, or even in the world as a whole, it knows, as it were, about this balance between its spirited aspect, its levity, and its material aspect, its gravity. And so it finds its place in the ecological whole, and has its own intrinsic beauty that speaks to the beauty of the whole. Well, in the third round of hell, they've lost all levity. And so they just sink and fall flat, these souls. They're drawn purely by the weight and the gravity of existence, which leaves them sort of flat and unable to even really move. They lack that inner vitality. And so they're both lying down, and Dante's able to tread on them, and because they've still got remnants of their material substance, which they've kind of dragged with them into the third round. It's very interesting to think about levity, because it's a word now that tends to mean kind of lightness and laughter. And that's an echo of the much richer ontology of the medieval mind. You know, and when someone has a kind of spirited nature, you might say, and they're able to laugh, they're able to take pleasure, they're able to show humour, and they have a kind of lightness in their body. You know, they're definitely physically with you, but they sit on that physicality, sit with that physicality sort of rather lightly. And so they bring life, and when you're in their company, people that have levity. And that's still how we experience, I think, this old medieval sense of levity, which was supposed to infuse the material world with a kind of lightness, with a kind of laughter and a humour, and with pleasure and gaiety. That's gone in the third round, and so the souls are flat on their faces, and Dante is able to tread upon them. Now then, one sits up, asks Dante, "Who am I?" Dante, again, sort of stressing this formlessness of this third round. Dante can't recognise this soul. And this soul says, "But I shared the city of Florence with you. We lived at the same time." Dante looks at him, and as it were, even his, you might say that what gave him his character in life has gone. And so even though his sort of fleshly appearance should be familiar, because that inner vitality is not pushing out, Dante can't recognise who it is. And the soul has to tell him, the soul has to remind him. It's actually a chap called Cacco. I think there's a bit of a kind of alliteration in the name there. Cacco is someone that hasn't been identified as an actual living Florentine. But nonetheless, he and Dante speak. It's very interesting that the first thing that Cacco says is, "Do you remember me?" This is a theme which is going to show up now in the Inferno, that the characters who are there, they're very keen on being remembered. I think it's partly because there's a vague sense that if you're remembered, you're prayed for, maybe it would assist you in hell. I think it's also because what starts to show up for Dante now is that the souls are very preoccupied with the past. They're they're constantly, as it were, going over in their minds what happened in their life. They're caught. It's part of this repetition compulsion, which we noted earlier, that they're stuck with how things were on earth. And of course, how things were on earth is now shaping their experience in hell. And that's why they're in hell. They're, as it were, not able to experience anything new. But as much as they're preoccupied with the past, they're also, it starts to become clear that they're very fixated on the future too. And in fact, Cacco here, when him and Dante start talking, Dante asks him about politics, more political concerns around Florence, rather than, say, the more personal concerns that preoccupied Dante when they met the Lustful. And I think this is because politics was how Dante experienced this excessive materiality, this excessive materialism. Because Florence had fallen into similarly a kind of undifferentiated state, it had become disfigured itself, much like the souls in hell, and in this third round of hell, and Cacco himself have become disfigured. You know, it's a warring body politic, you might say. It's a dishonest body politic. It's constantly grabbing, it's not flourishing. And then particularly with this sort of civil war, which is so particularly disfiguring of civic life. So that's how Dante inquires to Cacco about the meaning of this state that they find themselves in. How Cacco responds is by giving a prophecy of the future. Very interesting that they seem to have a kind of particularly keen sight for the future, these souls, but without being that clear about it at the same time. So Cacco gives these kind of vague intimations that that two are going to fight and then three sons will rise, and it's given in this rather gnomic form that is left rather unexplained in the canto, and people have tried to explain it about the Guelphs and the Ghibellines fighting, and the White Guelphs particularly, which was Dante's side, whether they're going to triumph or not, and they've made inferences to the Pope at the time, who wavered and couldn't decide who to back, which deepened and intensified the warfare. But in the canto itself, this is left unclear, which I think is, again, is part and parcel of this state, that even though Cacco can see something of the future, he can't really make sense of it still. So this sense of bad discernment pervades the whole mood of the canto. Certain qualities do come up, though, and again, they're perverse qualities. So talk of pride, talk of envy, and talk of avarice comes up. And I think, you know, pride is the desire to possess, to hold on to say it's mine, rather than to experience it as the flow of life. Envy, you might say, is not just the desire to have what someone else has, but to destroy what this other person has if you don't have it. So it has this sort of destructive, dissolving quality, envy. Avarice is the desire to accumulate more and more. It's the mistaken idea that you can enrich life by accumulating more. That too begins to get shown up in this canto. They talk about this, and then Cacco says, you know, that's it, that's me done for that's all I've got to say to you. It's as if he becomes a bit sort of exhausted, or he just quite quickly reaches the end of his capacity to converse. And this is a very interesting moment where it says that he gazed at Dante for a moment and he squinted in his eyes and then just kind of collapsed back to lying down, to falling to the ground of the third round. And I think this is Cacco having the briefest glimpse that actually he'd seen Dante, that something new and unexpected had happened in the present moment in this third round, and he was trying to get a fix on it, trying to focus on it, trying to see and understand it, but he couldn't, and so collapses back into his kind of overwhelming nature, which is his condemnation, and so falls back onto the ground. Virgil then steps in and says that these souls will be lying now flat on their faces until the final judgment. And he gives a bit of sort of Hell 101 again, as Virgil often does. He says that the unfriendly judge will come and judge them, and give them their bodies back. And then Dante and him talk about that, and as it were, their pain will intensify. Now, I think that the fact that Virgil talks about the unfriendly judge here is a bit of a clue that Virgil's got something of the truth with the final judgment, but not the whole of the truth. And in fact, the whole of the truth may turn out to be very, very different indeed, because, of course, the final judge will be the loving judge. And indeed, Virgil and Dante, we're told, have one of their conversations, which they don't tell us all about at this point. And it's one of these secrets, which I think means that at this juncture in hell, this third round, neither Dante the pilgrim nor we the listener are quite able to understand, quite able to really see deeply enough into at this point. And we're being led on the descent as readers too. This is part of our initiation, so that our imagination can open up that little bit more, so that we can see and understand more deeply, much as has begun to happen to Dante in this round. And indeed, we do get the sense by the end of it that he's not weeping, he's not swooning. He does mention a few times he felt like weeping, but he doesn't actually do it. And I think that that's because Dante is beginning to get to grips with what this descent is really going to ask of him, sort of in his consciousness, in his awareness. It's going to ask of him to begin to see things more clearly, not just, as it were, receive the things he's always been told, but to know it for himself, to see there's more subtlety, more wisdom going on than perhaps he'd realised. And he's getting a sense, you might say, of the value of the descent. The canto ends rather interestingly with the appearance of another mythical creature, the figure of Plutus. But it ends there, canto 6, and we pick up who Plutus might be in the next canto, linking the two cantos together, again for the first time in the Inferno, but suggesting perhaps that canto 7 is going to deepen our wisdom, our understanding of what's going on further.